if you walk around thinking a story can happen anywhere, then like the world kind of glistens and you can see, you know, a story there, a story in this small detail, a story here. And that to me is so much more powerful than walking around the world saying, I'm gonna go get this story and having blinders on to the rest of the world around you. I think there's so much more joy in being open to what the world throws your way. And I think that applies in love too, is like, if you have a set idea of what you want and need, you can totally miss so many things that could have come your way.
How's it going, everybody? It's great to welcome you back for another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast, where I interview the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. Today is episode 10. We've reached double digits. It's a milestone. And today, or the day this podcast comes out, my three-week trip to New York is just coming to an end. So I've been working as an independent documentary filmmaker and video journalist for the last few years. And this trip was a way for me to learn about the documentary filmmaking industry and connect with filmmakers and production companies that may have opportunities that would get me a foot in the door to start learning from the best of the best. So that's what I've been doing the last few weeks. It's been a fantastic trip. I learned a ton and hope to share some of those learnings with you all in the following week or so. This week on the podcast, my guest is Zandra Clark, who I met when we were both working at a radio show at Stanford University. Zandra is an actor, writer, documentarian, musician, performance maker, and all-around storyteller. On the performance side of things, Zandra is currently a 2018-19 Queer Art Fellow in Performance, a member of the Bats Company at the Flea, a company member of Poetic Theater Productions, and a performer and experience designer with immersive performance company Odyssey Works. As an audio documentarian, Zandra has worked at StoryCorps and was the founder of the True Story Podcast, which is a podcast of true personal stories told live at intimate gatherings, which has over 6 million downloads. Zandra's latest work is a show called Polylogs, which is a solo show about non-monogamy that combines her passions for theatrical and audio storytelling. In this conversation, Zandra and I talk about the process of creating Polylogs, how she blends storytelling mediums to foster understanding of diverse perspectives, and the power of being open and receptive to the stories that the world presents you. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Zandra Clark. Zandra Clark.
Austin Meyer. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for joining the podcast. Can you share with the listeners, where are we right now?
We're in Brooklyn, New York, in Crown Heights, which is the neighborhood that I live in. We're in my apartment.
So for those who don't know, I've been in New York for the last few weeks visiting documentary production studios, trying to get my foot in the door in this industry. And one thing that I've noticed is almost all of my meetings are in Brooklyn.
Really?
Yeah, like almost all of them. Huh. And in fact, there was one meeting that was in like midtown, downtown Manhattan. And even on the way there, I'm like...
Midtown, downtown Manhattan?
Maybe I'm saying that wrong.
There's midtown and then there's downtown. And then there's uptown.
Okay, it was midtown, Manhattan.
Yeah.
And I just knew going there, like, this probably isn't going to be for me because it was, like, in a high-rise in Midtown. Yeah. I'm like, there feels like too much money for this to be my type of environment. And I was right.
Yeah. Did so you go to Dumbo a lot?
Dumbo?
Yeah. That's Dumbo, where a lot Brooklyn. Of documentary stuff.
So there's a lot happening here in Brooklyn. Is that why you moved here? Why choose this area when you came to New York?
Well, when I first came, it was a more affordable area. And so that was kind of like the primary reason. And then also when I first moved here, I got an intern. Well, when I first moved, I was crashing with my sister who already lived in Brooklyn. So I had kind of a soft spot for it because she was already here. And then, I got an internship at StoryCorps, and the StoryCorps office is in Brooklyn. So I would be close.
Yeah.
So I've actually lived in Crown Heights for 5.5 years now.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So getting into you, like how you arrived in New York, we'll get a little bit of your backstory. I'm always curious to hear, like, what was the first time that you remember, like, storytelling kind of struck a chord with you, or that you wanted to kind of pursue a path of telling stories? Was there a moment or a particular story you worked on that, like, really energized you?
Well, I think that journey goes back to childhood for theater, because I think that was the first place where I fell in love with story, but I don't think I realized it was story that was the thing I was in love with. Because the first play that I did, or the first play that I really remember, was I was 8 years old, and I got cast in a show that was exploring this kind of Indian myth called the Ramayana, and it's the story of Ram, and my father is from India, and I got cast as Ram's wife, Sita. And it was this big experience for me in sort of cultural heritage and storytelling, but then also this kind of like epic myth that was being explored. And I got to take on this character that felt totally different from me, but then somehow connected to me, because, you know, my dad used to read me the story when I was a kid and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it was like this connection of like, I'm stepping into the story that I had known, and there was something really exciting about that, and I got to be this character in this epic tale. And
was that like elementary school?
That was, I was eight.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So I was very young. Mm-hmm. It was like a children's production. Mm-hmm. And so then I started getting into it more and more in school, and I think I started to feel that what I loved about it was being able to see the world from another perspective. Mm-hmm. And that's what I felt like, you know, this is why I love acting, is getting into a character and seeing the world from someone else's eyes. Mm-hmm. And then in college, I think it was my junior year.
And you did theater, like, throughout high school?
Throughout
you were kind
high
of a
school,
theater kid?
Yeah, I was a theater kid. Yeah. I, like, did in middle school and in freshman year of high school, I was still doing sports. I was doing field hockey and squash.
Okay.
But then you kind of had to choose what you did after school. Yep. And so then I ended up like dropping all those, doing all the theater. And then in college, I went to college knowing I wanted to be a drama major.
Okay.
And I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to be an actor. Like, that's my life. But I was excited to go to Stanford because I wanted to learn a whole lot of other things, because I've always been very curious about the world and, you know, things that I can learn that are not just acting.
Because presumably some people who are like solely focused on acting, they might go to a school where that's the focus, right?
Like a conservatory.
Okay.
Right, like Juilliard or something, where you're like focusing on building your movement, your voice, your, you know, acting skills, Shakespeare, working on text, like all those things that you would focus on. And the drama major at Stanford had some of that, but it was, I mean, it's a liberal arts education. It's not, you know, artistic conservatory style. And so I knew that I was choosing a place where I could explore other things. Not that I thought anything would convince me otherwise, but that I, you know, just wanted to explore.
Yeah.
But then my junior year, because I was taking a lot of creative writing classes, I really enjoyed writing. Mm-hmm. And my junior year, I took a class on writing for the radio. And I had never explored radio, but that was the first place where, I mean, in high school, I had done some interviews for school projects, but this was the first place where I was asked, like, do you want to interview we all get to interview someone and then craft a story from that.
Okay.
So that was a very different thing than, like, in high school, you know, I would do a project for a research paper where I would interview someone in a certain career or with a certain experience or something like that. But this was, like, interview someone and then you make a story about it. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to interview my dad, so I used the excuse of this class to talk to my dad about something I had been scared to talk to him about.
Oh, interesting.
Which was that my whole childhood had been very spiritual. He was a really big meditator. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 16, he totally flipped and became atheist and was like, it's all, you know, not true. It's just, you know, I made myself believe whatever. Hmm. And so I said, I want to know what happened, because I had been kind of following his path and then, you know, was radically kind of, the rug was pulled from under me when he changed. And so I had always kind of been curious. I had assumed it was a midlife crisis and that someday he would come around, you know.
Yeah.
But then, you know, by that time I was a junior in college. I was 21 and he hadn't, you know, so it had been 5 years. And so I interviewed him. And that was when I started to realize that I had, it kind of, and over the years I've been kind of puzzling or piecing the puzzle pieces together. Because then I think now I've realized that I've always loved from childhood asking questions and learning about people and listening. But it was through that class and creating that story and then getting into this program that we have at Stanford called the Stanford Storytelling Project and the radio show that they have as part of that, that then I decided I wanted to pursue a master's in journalism, because I now started to realize that really it was story. It was story at the heart of all these characters and plays and projects that I had done, that I wanted to understand how to be a better storyteller and how to listen to people better and understand what the stories are kind of beneath all our experiences. So that's why I pursued the master's in journalism. And so at that point I was like, maybe I don't want to be an actor. Maybe I want to be a journalist. Maybe I want to do something different. And I just, you know, at the heart of that love has been story, and maybe there's something else exploring story that will feel more resonant.
Yeah. Ask
please.
A follow-up on the that first piece you did for the class. How do you think that you may have approached your father or asked him questions in a different way than you would have if you were just like sitting at the dinner table and were like, hey dad, I have a question, and it wasn't for a story? Like, what did that...
Yeah, it made such a huge difference. I think, I don't know, somehow having the microphone, it makes it official in this way that it lends a certain reverence to the conversation in a different way than without the microphone. So without the microphone, it's easy to get distracted or, hold on 1 second, Xandra, let me just make this phone call, or, you know, it's time for me to cook dinner or whatever it is, or you get distracted by seeing something, or you just kind of follow a different conversation. And for some reason, having the microphone, it was like, we're gonna sit down, we're gonna have, you know, an hour long conversation.
Yeah.
And I just get to ask you all these questions. Mm-hmm. And so it gives it an importance and significance that is pretty singular, I think, when you have that equipment there. That almost like this equipment is like a tool for a ritual or something. And you're like, you create the ritual by putting it there in between you. And so I think some people talk about being intimidated by the microphone or it being a barrier, but I think actually the opposite. I think it is a way in, and that it creates a space of openness, I think, in a different way than can be experienced when you're just having a conversation without it.
What about doing voice recordings and constructing a story through audio connected with you in a way that maybe just purely writing didn't? Because then you went on to do the Stanford Storytelling Project where you were focusing on audio storytelling. Right. So like what connected with you on in terms of the audio?
Yeah, well, what really connected or what felt exciting at that time was that I was getting to explore real stories. Mm. So previously, I had been in the world of theater, the world of fiction, fantasy, you know, exploring these imaginative worlds or fictional storylines. And this was, and even though that I always felt helped me understand people better, this was understanding real people better, who I actually know exist, who are in the world, who I can actually make an active effort to listen to better or understand better. And so it was very exciting to understand a way to access those truer stories. And not that, because fiction, I think, is true in a different way. There's a different kind of truth. But there was, I had an excitement around documentary, you know, like learning real stories and figuring out how to tell those back. And so audio interviewing and radio production was a way where I could explore that.
What was one of the biggest challenges for you as a storyteller once you started doing more work in audio at the Stanford Storytelling Project to make those stories come to life in audio? What is like one of the key learnings maybe that you had when you were first starting out how to tell stories through audio?
What was one of the key learnings you had?
Nice.
Nice pivot.
Nice. Got me. So one thing that I was learning when I first started doing the audio stories, I've always been really interested in the use of music and storytelling. And I think that probably is derived from how I got my start as a videographer, was making like stupid, goofy music videos with my friends back in high school. So I always like would see, even to this day, like I hear music and I see visuals, I see story. The other day I was in the West Village and I was just like hanging out on the couch, I was surfing and heard the song come on. And I was like, I need to put visuals to that. And so when I first started doing audio stories, I had no sense of how to use music to heighten emotion. And it was only until I started making them that I became more conscious of it when I'd listen to programs like This American Life or Radiolab and how they use music and sound design to amplify emotion. And I think, yeah, so I learned how to use music. And the way I think about it now is the music I like to use in my stories are, I don't like to use a lot of melody. It's more like pads, like synth pads that kind of create emotion. And I usually tie that music to, you know, it comes and goes with themes in the story. For example, if one of the people in a story I'm making, you know, maybe is reflecting on their childhood, I'll bring in music there if that's the feeling I want. And then when they stop reflecting on their childhood, I fade out that music while, you know, something else happens. And then maybe they go back into their childhood, you bring up the music. So music as tied to themes. And just being more intentional about how I use music, I remember that was like a key learning for me. Because otherwise, I just like to use music over everything.
Yeah.
And then you lose the power.
Yeah.
So that was something I learned early on when I was doing some work at the Storytelling Project.
I feel so, yeah, this is good, because I think one key thing that I learned, which was so basic actually, but is just the structure of a well-told story, which I think previously, you know, even in things I had written and things I had done, I had understood story to be, you know, beginning, middle, and end. But I think a key thing that I learned at the Storytelling Project is understanding what happens between the middle and the end, which is transformation. And so what is the thing that the character is going through and how does that change them? And I think that was a really key learning, that like that's what makes a really compelling story is when you see change of some kind. You see someone go through something and they come out a different person. That's what teaches us things. That's what, you know, we understand what an experience is like because we see what someone went through and who they became on the other end. And so I think that's like a very small thing, but very fundamental that I think really changed my ability to tell stories.
I think another thing that I took out of that was I was coming from a creative writing background as well, similar to you. And I was getting really into writing fiction. And I was having a lot of fun with like complex sentence structure and like flowery imagery and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, I was
that.
Big on the flowery imagery.
Absolutely. And then I just had to learn a whole new writing style for radio, which was like very simple. You write as though you, like just how you speak. And And that was hard for me.
Oh yeah, I had to rein in all of my instincts to make all these metaphors and images.
Yeah. And also, I learned about like how in radio, you have to do like a lot of signposting or mm-hmm. repeating details.
Yeah.
Because like you'll see this, I know they do it in like Radio Lab all the time, where they literally tell the listener like, I'm about to say something important, listen up. You know, because like they know people are on the move, they might be in their car. So doing those kind of like signposting things was really different for me too. And lastly, last point there, is in telling stories through radio, it was one of the first times that I was being a little bit more, clear at the end of like, here's a takeaway. Like, here's why you're listening to this story.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't think you always have to have that in a story, but I notice in radio it happens a lot, or audio storytelling is like, here's why you're listening to this.
Yes, and actually this is really interesting you say that, because I feel like the transition for me coming back into theater
mm-hmm.
after kind of like pivoting off into radio, but going back into theater, but with the understanding that I wanna also explore this fusion between theater and journalism and what is it to tell documentary stories through live performance. But when I came back, there's sort of, and even this project that I've been working on this year, that's a documentary theater project, there's been a journey of how do I not treat the audience as dumb? Because mm-hmm. so often in radio, we have to signpost and we have to give the clear takeaway because exactly, people are on the go, they're listening, you know, they're only getting the story through one sense. Mm-hmm. But in live performance, they're getting it through all their senses, and they're in an audience with other people experiencing it together. So there's a different kind of engagement, I think. Mm-hmm. And so I was finding that in my scripting of live performance over the last few years when I've been doing documentary-based work, is often I was doing the signposting too much for the audience and getting the feedback, you know, just trust the audience. Like they're gonna follow you. They're with you. You know, you don't need to tell them exactly where you're going because you're taking them there. Yeah. And in theater, the journey is a little bit different, where you want to be a step ahead of the audience all the time, where they're kind of trying to catch up, and rather than you kind of babying them and holding their hand and saying, all right, I'm going to take you this way, I'm going to take you this way, so that they're kind of like falling behind you, kind of rolling down through this story, rather than I think in radio where people do kind of have to follow more intentionally because they're only hearing it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Why do you think that's the norm in theater? Is that a norm in theater?
Well, I think theater is inherently active. Because it's live, it's really a conversation between the audience and the performer. So whereas radio, the listeners are kind of passive recipients. Like, if they start laughing, the audio isn't going to stop. The person's going to keep talking in their ear.
Mm-hmm.
If they, you know, are confused, they can't. I mean, they can ask a neighbor if they're listening with someone, but it's a different thing. Mm-hmm. So in theater, it's always responsive,
mm-hmm.
and so the audience is reacting in a certain way, and the performers are responding to it, even in very subtle ways. And so I think because of that, it's a very active storytelling experience on all sides. And so that makes it really alive and exciting in a different way, that I think the audience is more on the edge of their seats if it's a good work,
right.
I think.
Right.
And so then they're more actively engaged and participating in the flow of the story,
yeah.
I think.
So you did your master's in journalism, but you also are doing a lot of theater performance on the side. And so once you graduated, how did you make the decision about what did you want to do?
Yeah, well, I wasn't sure, because I actually, I did think about journalism, and I think I realized pretty quickly. I think I knew in the journalism program that I didn't want to work in a newsroom. I wasn't interested in covering breaking news and that kind of thing. What I was interested in really was investigation and long form storytelling. I still was like, you know, do I want to be an actor? Do I want to be a journalist? And at the time, I wrote my master's thesis on collaborations between journalists and performers. So I think already I was like, how can I do both?
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah, and that was a great excuse to interview all these people that I wanted to talk to. Mm-hmm. Because I was like, I'm writing my master's thesis about this. You know, yeah. I need to talk to you.
So you can reach out to all your heroes.
Yeah, exactly. I reached out to all my heroes. Or many of them.
Yeah.
And they did interviews with me. And so then when I moved to New York, I moved to New York for a variety of reasons. My two sisters lived here. I had applied for an internship at StoryCorps, and I at first...
Which is, for the listeners, that's a radio show.
It's a nonprofit, and it's an oral history project, really, where they record conversations between two people who know one another, mm-hmm. and then all of those interviews get archived at the Library of Congress.
Could have been like the interview you did with your father.
Right, exactly.
It's similar to that. Exactly. It's often family
similar
members,
to
right?
That. Yeah. Yep. And then they edit, you know, 2 to 3 minute stories every week that get aired on NPR stations. Mm-hmm. That are, you know, some of the best stories. And then there are many other departments. There's an animation series through StoryCorps. They have books. So they do a variety of different things. But so I had applied to an internship there and didn't get it, but it was because the person who had the internship previously wanted to stay on. But they said, you know, we really liked you. We want to keep you, you know, kind of on hand. And then as it turned out, 3 months later, she got promoted. And so I got the internship.
Great.
And so I had just moved here. So there was that kind of in the air that I might get that. And there was a performance company that I had started kind of working with. And they were doing a project here this summer. They do immersive performance experiences for one person at a time. Mm-hmm. So they had been commissioned by this theater festival here to do a performance for
gotcha.
One person. And so I was really curious about this because this was also a type of documentary performance where it involved interviewing this one person, their friends, their family, people who knew them, and trying to understand who this person was and then creating a show that maybe would just appeal to them and no one else. And the show is not a typical show that like you walk into a theater and see a show. It was events or experiences or encounters that would happen in their life that they wouldn't necessarily know are part of the performance.
Okay.
But they knew they've signed up for the performance.
Interesting.
Over a durational period of time.
Yeah.
So huh. I was very interested in this as like a way to explore real stories through performance
yeah.
or interact with real people as themselves in performance. And what is that? So that's why, so there were those, and then I was like, you know, and I can see when I'm here whether I gravitate more towards acting and theater and the arts or journalism, documentary,
yeah.
because
you're
there's
kind of
so
still
much
exploring.
Here. Exactly.
Exploring two different kind of things.
Exactly. So I explored for a while, and I ended up getting hired by StoryCorps too, and so I worked there, and then I was acting as well, you know, getting into shows, and on a smaller level. But both of these felt like, you know, I'm still exploring. I'm not at a level I want to be yet.
Yeah.
And over time, it felt like it wasn't a lie that I loved performance. You know, I think there was a time when I was studying journalism where I thought maybe story is the thing and really acting was just this other way, but really I want to do journalism. But no, I think I realized that performance is really, it's something I really, really love. And I have that that drive to do it. And I think I'm good at it. And like creating spaces where performance can happen is something that I could do as well.
Yeah.
So performing, but then also what is it to create and to make a space? And I started, actually what really helped too was I thought about applying for an MFA in acting. so that I could improve my skills. And writing statements of purpose for those applications was so helpful because it made me realize, like, I tried writing a mission statement for myself.
Yeah.
And I realized that my mission statement was, at least, you know, when I wrote it then, which was a few years ago, was to create spaces where people are open to understanding other points of view. And that's a very kind of like broad, that could happen in a variety of ways. But what I felt was the method for me to do that was through performance. But I also felt a passion for documentary. And so I felt that like the best spaces, or at least what I was compelled to do right then and still now, is like the spaces of creating understanding and having people look at things from a new perspective that I'm most excited and kind of best equipped to create those spaces through more kind of experimental documentary performance.
So maybe you can share the project that you're currently working on.
Sure, yeah. So the project I'm currently working on is called Polylogs. And it is, so it's a show, I would say, that is about non-monogamous relationships, people in non-monogamous relationships. So for the last year and a half, I've been interviewing people of a wide variety of backgrounds, a wide variety of experiences with non-monogamy or polyamory. And then so I'm both kind of an audio producer and a performer in this because I'll
interview
them.
Taking from those two worlds.
Yeah, exactly.
Blending them together.
Exactly, because I'm interviewing all these folks, and then I edit the audio of those interviews into basically audio stories. But most of the people I interview want to remain anonymous, so it sort of made sense. And I can talk a little bit about how the show developed too, but it made sense for it to be spoken by someone else because they didn't want their name out, they didn't want their voice heard, they didn't want their identity to be associated with their story. So what I'm doing is I edit the audio stories, and then I actually play those audio stories in my ear through headphones while I perform and speak a split second after they speak in my ear as them. So I, you know, as much as I can, I adopt, you know, their voice, their pace, their accent, you know, how, and their physicality, like however I experience them telling me the story and however they're speaking in my ear, I try to embody as best I can. And so, and really, you know, and that's how it, yes, the show is about non-monogamous relationships, but as we were talking about a little bit before this interview started, is that really at the heart of it, it's about love and why we love the way we do, how has tradition taught us to love, and how can we love maybe differently or look at the way we're loving and be more intentional about it. And I think, you know, so much of society right now is about hate and about, you know, kind of ostracizing people because of difference. And I think I do, there is something very, very like idealistic about me in the sense that I do, I am a very hopeful person, and I believe in our ability to love better as people. And so what I found, because it started, this whole project started very much as a, like a curious investigation about like, how are people living in this way? And then it became, at the more and more people I interviewed and more stories I heard, the more and more I realized like, this is like, there's so many amazing learnings here about how we can communicate better and how we can listen better and understand better and make better choices and be more intentional about our choices and be more open. And so that has been amazing, is to realize that like really at the heart of all this is love, because like that's just, I mean, that's like the heart of everything, you know.
When you started doing those interviews, did you, in your head, were you thinking this is going to be a show down the line, or were you just like, you know, I'm curious about this, let me just start talking to people? And at what point, if that was the case, did you start to think maybe I could like thread these together?
Yeah, so not at all. And actually, I'll circle back to the answer to that question, but what you made me think of too is that, you know, I think a lot of people have the kind of understanding about story that you know what story you want to get, and then you go out there and you get it, and then you tell it as best you can. And I think I have a different approach to story. My approach to story is that stories are everywhere. Everyone has them. They're not anything fancy. We all have stories. And that I'm more interested in listening to the world around me and to the people around me and what are the stories that come up. And when they arise, is that a story I think I can tell in some way? And how do I tell it? And how I understand how I tell it is by listening more and better and saying, okay, what is the story that is emerging? Rather than having, I think, a preconceived notion of the story that I think should be told or that I think is needing to be told, and like I go out there and get it and tell it. It's much more, what is the story that needs to be told? You tell me. You tell me what has to get out there. And and so that's like, been my approach.
Yeah, so in that sense, you're like, your skill set is as a listener and then figuring out what is the best way to communicate those and organize those to like send that message to an audience.
And really to remain true to that person's story rather than, oh, let me fit this person's story into this larger story that I want to tell, this like agenda that I have to get out this message or to, you know, tell this story in this particular way or frame this experience in this particular way. But instead, yeah, exactly. What is the truth of this person's story and how can I tell that in a way that really honors it and respects it? That is like of the utmost importance to me in the kind of work that I do is whoever I'm interviewing, that I am in service of them. They're not in service of my story. I'm in service of them. And so this all started, back to your question, because so I had been experimenting with this form of where I speak the interview as I hear it in my ear. Because so actually I did a workshop 5 years ago with Anna Deavere Smith, and she was actually someone who I interviewed as part of my master's thesis, and she's an incredible performer, writer, playwright, and she makes she's kind of known well for making one-woman shows where she will interview a lot of people around a topic and then perform all of them. So a similar kind of verbatim style performance, documentary-based performance. And one of the ways she learns the person's words is by listening to the audio over and over again. But what I found actually when I was auditioning for MFA, acting MFA programs, in final callbacks at one school, they gave us this as an assignment, was to go out and interview someone and edit the audio and give us, you know, a 90-second story. And I already was really into this form. And so then I tried it and I just loved it. I loved doing it. You know, I got to, I actually did it twice. So I interviewed my neighbor, and then the following year when I had auditioned again, I did, you know, my uncle. And so I loved getting to do that, have that experience of like interviewing and then actually I'm speaking the words that I'm hearing. And there was something about when I had learned from Anna and, you know, that type of solo work where you just perform someone without the audio, where you're just, you know, speaking the words. There was something about it that I wasn't sure that I would necessarily want to do that. I was more like, well, I'll just do audio. Like, I'll let the person speak for themselves. Why am I speaking their words when they can just speak it themselves? So, because I really valued that. Like, let someone speak their own story. Why would I do it for them? But what was exciting about this forum was that I felt like I wasn't creating a character when I was listening in headphones. I was just letting this person overtake me and almost possess me and speak through me. And so it felt very different than I think if I were trying to create a character, have the text memorized, kind of create a character and speak it as, you know, myself, the actor on the stage. It just felt like a different experience.
Yeah.
So I was really interested in this form. And then I was interested in, I've always loved talking about love and relationships, and I've always been curious. And even when I was a kid, you know, my mom used to tell me that, like, I would even ask adults really personal questions because I was always curious. And, you know, I would just say, like, how do you make your marriage work? Like, what's the key, you know, and all these, you know, and I was just always, you know, I wanted to know about people's lives and how relationships worked. And so I got invited to perform at a performance night here in New York that I could share 10 minutes of whatever I wanted. And I had been kind of talking with people who I knew in non-monogamous relationships. And so I said, hey, maybe I'll go to them and ask if I can formally interview them and do, you know, 3 monologues for this show. So that's what I did. So they let me interview them and I did 3 monologues at this performance. And I just thought it was a little experiment, a little, you know, I was trying this thing. And then, first of all, the interviews, I was just so interested in them. And I just loved having these conversations about this. And then when I performed, the response was so amazing that, first of all, people coming up to me saying, I have all these questions too. I'm so curious about these things, but I don't know who to ask. Like, do you have friends? Like, I don't know anyone in my life who's poly or who's, and so, like, I don't know who to ask these questions to. And then other people coming up to me and saying, I identify as poly, but I'm not out, and I've never seen a representation so normal, rather than the way it's often portrayed in the media as sensationalized or ridiculed. It's kind of one or the other. And so there were kind of both sides of people coming up to me, and the way they would come up to me too was like this excited, kind of like hushed way of like, oh my God, this is happening. Like, you're doing this. This is amazing. Like, please keep doing this, you know? And I started to, and so then I got invited to perform at a couple other performance nights. And so I kept doing interviews here and there.
Gotcha.
And
so you're slowly kind of like building it piece by piece,
right,
testing it out.
Right. And I wasn't thinking, oh, I'll make a show. Mm-hmm. I was just like, there's something here. Mm-hmm. There's something here from many sides. And I think this was like, this is kind of like the holy grail of storytelling, I think, is where I'm really excited about it as the creator. Like, the topic is really, really interesting to me. Having these conversations is amazing. And then I can see in the response that the conversation is wanted and needed and not happening. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not out there in the world. And so it was kind of this combination of both those things that the more and more I did these stories, the more and more I realized there was a need for it, and the more content I saw that there really was. Like, there's a whole slew of stories and diversity of experiences that have to do with non-monogamy that just have not been explored in the media.
Yeah.
And so then kind of, I guess, like, at the end of last year, so that was in July last year, 2017, was when I did that first experiment. And then by the end of last year, I kind of knew this had to be a whole show. And I also was kind of working on some other ideas in other mediums, and still am. But I thought, you know, first and foremost, I think it needs to be a show. And it made sense for it to be a solo show because all of these people, or most of them, were not out and wanted their identity protected. And then also there was something I loved, and, you know, my director too, when she came on board, loved about, it's an exploration about loving many people, but really at the heart of it is also self-love and, like, how do you know yourself well enough to know what you want and to ask for what you want. And so having it as, like, a solo journey is actually, I think, really interesting to the project,
as opposed to having other performers come on stage and act out different voices.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So that's how it developed. So then, you know, since the end of last year to this year, it's been just like writing that full script and you know, creating that larger arc.
So one of the choices that I noticed that you made in the show is and for the audience, you know, it's Xandra in, you know, a pretty intimate small space. You know, an audience kind of surrounds her on three sides, pretty much. A small stage, one chair, I think, in the middle of the stage, and she'll come on alone with her headphones in and take on the physicality and the accent of the people she's listening to, speak for anywhere from like 30 seconds to 5 minutes sometimes. And while she's speaking, there's a projected name on the back wall. So when those characters come back throughout the story, you can kind of start to build a connection and kind of follow those people. And then one thing I noticed, and I'm curious to hear more about, is you, Xandra, are very present in the story. Like there's one interview which I thought was really interesting, where the body position, the physicality that Xandra takes on is someone who's clearly on a computer. And you're talking to that person through the computer, and you say your own name because you're speaking for that other person. And I'm curious why you made the decision to kind of put yourself into the story as opposed to just the voices of those who are speaking.
Well, one thing I love about these interviews and the way that I think they're edited in the show is that there are particular moments like that that pull us into the present moment of the interview. Because I think the show is about love, it's about all those things. It's also about listening. Because you're actually, as the audience, you're listening to these stories and you're practicing listening better at the same time as you're watching the journalist performer listen herself and try to do as best she can to like listen the best possible, you know? So like there are layers of listening. And you can kind of fall into the stories that are being told, but then those moments like that where, for example, this one character that you're referring to says, you know, like, is telling his story and then says at one point, like, more importantly, Xandra, like this. And I think that small moment just, it reminds us, oh, this is an interview, in a way that I think is really exciting because it is good to get lost in the stories, but it's also, I think, good to remember that these stories are being told to a specific person, to me. And so even though it's being performed for an audience, really it's an intimate conversation that's happening. And so reminding the audience that it is that is, I think, important. And because, yes, I'm being like as objective, quote unquote, as possible as I can be in the show or in my editing of the stories, but like nothing is objective. I'm not objective. And so I actually think it's helpful to remind the audience, this was told to Xandra and Xandra is the one who edited these stories. So take that as you will. You can judge accordingly. Maybe this person would have told you the story differently. Mm-hmm. But keep reminding yourself that this is the frame, this is the lens that the story has been told in. Because I actually think that's much more important than claiming to be unbiased and saying, oh, well, I'm an objective journalist, so like I know that like these are like the ultimate truth of the stories. No, the stories were told to me, and I have a particular dynamic with each storyteller, and so they told it in a particular way to me. And so I think it's nice to give the audience some agency in judging that accordingly.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about how filmmakers specifically, or how and or why they choose to put themselves into films. Like when I was in like the past few years, I've always kind of made this like decision in my head that like my voice cannot be in the film. Like, no matter what.
Yeah, why?
Because I think it's because I come from this journalism background where it's like you strive for objectivity, you try not to, like, put yourself into the story and just let the person speak for themselves. And then over time, I'm coming to understand, like, it's like people know that, like, you're filming them. Yeah. Like, it's okay to be honest about the whole scope of this project. And I struggled with that some when I was doing my documentary in Zambia. And I think the reason is because I was always so self-conscious about how I, as a white male covering like maternal health in Africa, was impacting the reality of the story. And so I felt like if I was in it at all, it would like really take away from the either credibility or authenticity of the experience that those women were having. And so I was always very careful about trying not to be a part of the story. And we'll see how that, you know, eventual documentary comes together and whether that will be a good choice or a bad choice. But like two of my favorite documentaries this year, one is Free Solo, which is about a climber's ascent of El Cap, free soloing El Cap. And the filmmakers are a integral part of the movie because part of the movie explores how the filmmakers had to make an ethical choice to make the film or not, knowing that this person has a high chance of dying. Was making this film putting extra pressure on this person, which could cause him to die? Mm. And so their ethical dilemma within themselves becomes a part of the story. So that's like a major part of the story, which was interesting for me to see. And then another one of my favorite documentaries this year is called On Her Shoulders. And it tracks Nadia Murad, who's one of the co-Nobel Peace Prize winners this year, who is a Yazidi woman from Iraq who like escaped ISIS and now is kind of sharing the story of her people to the whole world and kind of has that burden on her shoulders to tell this tragedy over and over again on TV and radio and all this kind of stuff to bring awareness to it. And that one, the filmmaker isn't in it much, but she reveals like these little moments that kind of break that wall and make you know she's there. Like that one point, the Nadia, the woman in the film, who the film follows, asks the filmmaker to take a photo of her. Hmm. And the filmmaker holds the camera phone like out in front of the actual lens she's using to shoot the documentary and takes the photo. Or when they sit down for an interview, sometimes they have the person clap and that's on film. So I think what you're right, and I think that's something that I need to think more about, is when you go into a story, there's no, like, to not be so set on all these stylistic decisions and to, like, let the form of the story dictate why you choose to do something, because it might be really valuable to include some of those moments.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because, like, right, it's that dual thing of like you as like the white man and an American white man,
right?
Like you want to let these women speak for themselves. At the same time, like the fact that you are a white American man telling this story is relevant to the way the story is told. And so like, how can you be honest about that at the same time as you're not inserting yourself into the story?
Right. Yeah, I'm still trying to figure that out.
Yeah. But those are like good questions,
you know?
Because it's not the kind of thing that, at least I don't think it should be something you think, well, I don't have a right to tell that story or to augment that story or whatever it is. But it's just, it needs to be done with real consciousness and care, I think, you know, of just like, how do we go about these things?
Right. How do you think, If you were to do an audio documentary of Polylogs and you were to speak for all the characters in their voices just like you did, but someone was listening on headphones, how do you think the impact would be different for an audience?
Well, it's interesting because I am considering something like this, actually. And I think it would be different, but I think it would work in a different way. Because, you know, in the theater, in the show, you'd see all my different physicality. And so in some sense, it's easier to maybe see different characters coming out.
Yeah, you have, she has a character like who's smoking, you know, just different ways they sit on the chair. And it really paints the picture of who this person is. That is powerful.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
But I think I would, and I'd done a lot of dialect work already for the stage show. I think I would have to do even more, and you know, be very, very, you know, distinct in all of the voices that I create. But then really, and yeah, I say create, but actually I'm not creating them. I'm trying to, and even like with my dialect coach, I'm trying to just listen really well to how the person is speaking and try to create that sound in my voice, which involves, you know, different ways of shifting, you know, my throat, where my tongue is, where, like all those little things, like how is that person moving their mouth? How wide is their mouth opening? Like very specific things. So, I think just kind of technically that would be like, I would have to think about that more. And then I think there could be something really nice about it in audio form too, which I think one benefit of the live show is that the audience gets to see other audience members react.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And respond to it. And so there's kind of there's a conversation between the audience and the performer, and there's a conversation among the audience. Mm-hmm. And in audio, I think it's a much more intimate experience between your one audience, primarily. Usually people, you know, listen to podcasts and headphones, and so they're receiving the information. And what's it's interesting to think about me being on headphones as I speak it and people being on headphones receiving it. I like that kind of like meta way of receiving the story. But then also something someone told me who saw the live show is that at the performance she attended, because basically the first full showing of it was just shown 2 weeks ago, but really it's still in development and it will be, you know, moving forward. But what she said is the performance she attended, people were laughing a lot. Mm-hmm. And she at times was feeling, why are they laughing? Or like, I feel much more emotionally impacted by this story that's being told, whereas other people are laughing. And so for her, actually, she felt that she might enjoy listening to it more than being in an audience because then she could just have her own personal journey with it rather than feeling influenced or annoyed by other audience members around her. She could just take in those stories and analyze for herself what her new views on love are or, you know, what she has learned differently rather than feeling the impact. So for someone like her, I think actually audio would make more sense and be that more intimate journey that she wants with these stories. For someone else, you know, who mentioned other audience, like watching other audience members was one of the exciting things about the show for him, was like seeing, because he's not someone who's poly, and so, but he could like see people in the audience who were responding and like, oh my God, like that feels like us, or like that, you know, and so that was really eye-opening for him, was like, wow, this, like, seeing a community of people around the show was actually really enlightening for him. So I think it's just a matter of what the person at hand kind of prefers or how they want their experience to be with these stories.
I can also imagine that if you're in the audience and people are reacting in ways that maybe you're not feeling, that'd be an interesting moment probably of reflection too.
Oh, yeah.
Of like, wait, I don't seem to be on board here. Like, why am I feeling a certain way that other people are not? So that's really interesting.
Yeah.
All right, we're almost out of time here. Let's see what we're at. We are at 56. So let's start to wrap up. And so I guess a couple last questions. I think you're doing like really interesting work with like blending these different mediums, audio and theater. And like I'm always thinking about all the different mediums too, because like I love to write, I love to do podcasts and interviews like this, I like to do video, and sometimes it feels like you gotta pick one, you know, you gotta go down a track. So
lies. It's all lies.
Yeah. So I guess for anyone else who's kind of like feeling like they have to like choose, like a specific path, maybe when they're at that stage that you were at, when they're still exploring what it is that excites them. Do you have any advice for people who are trying to figure out how to tell stories through blended mediums or are just not sure which one they want to choose?
Yeah. Well, I would say, because I feel like I'm still figuring it out. And I feel like when I'm 90, I'm still going to feel that way. And I think it's taken me time to accept that, that I think really follow your curiosity, you know? And if you're, like, don't feel like you need to hedge yourself into one thing too early. Because yes, I do think that in some sense it's important to focus on something so you can get really good at that thing. So then you can tell the stories as best you can. On the other hand, if you have a curiosity for other mediums, then explore those things. And it's okay if in 40 years you get curious about a different medium, or if you want to change, or maybe there is some blending that you can do. And I'm, you know, I guess I try to pair learning new skills with focus on the ones I have and try to do both, you know, in tandem of just, you know, how can I get better at the thing I'm already doing and how can I keep my curiosity alive and keep learning those other things, because I actually think that's very important. Because if you just say, I'm doing this one thing, forget about everything else, I think it's possible to like burn out or you lose your enthusiasm about it. Or, you know, you might miss out on some way that you could have told stories in a different way, you know, or in a combined blended way. So I don't know if that's helpful, but I think it's, yeah. I mean, there isn't like a clear answer, because I still am constantly like, well, should I focus on acting? I mean, it's only in the last like couple years that I've really accepted that I'm a, you know, I'm a hyphenated artist, you know?
Is that what, like, you say at like parties? People are like, what do you do?
Yeah, like, and I'm like, I'm hyphens. Yeah, like, I'm like creator slash performer slash writer slash 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 storyteller, you know, documentary maker.
Well, I mean, what I heard in your story through sharing kind of your background and also connects to the theme of my podcast, which is like the craft of storytelling. Whether you were learning how to tell stories through audio at the Stanford Storytelling Project, or like working with this mentor on how to do a one-woman show in a theatrical context, like all of that is you're learning how to tell a story.
Yeah.
And that's one of the one things where I feel like, that's why I want to interview people like you and in all these different genres, because once you become a really damn good storyteller, the tools out there to tell stories are, like, the barriers to entry are so low now that I think once you have, like, once you're a really good storyteller, you can really move between those seamlessly.
Yeah. And I think also in so many aspects of our society, people are very quick to categorize and to say, oh, choose the thing you are. What are you? Let me define you in this particular way. And, I mean, that's also thematically explored in the show of, like, the ways we try to, you know, box people in. And I think there's actually something amazing in saying, no, I'm not going to be boxed in, because the world is bigger than that. Or, you know, it's not so easy to just define people in boxes in any way. And so, like, to say, actually, no, I'm going to, you know, yes, I'm going to understand how to tell a story well. And then maybe at some point, maybe, and serve the story. You know, maybe the story needs to be a film. Maybe the story needs to be a play. Maybe the story just needs to be told around a fire. You know, whatever it is, but like, then you can just say, okay, what is the story that needs to be told? And how can I tell it best? And how can I learn the skills to learn that way that is going to tell the story best?
Before my last question,
yeah.
If people want to check out your work or follow you on social media or something, where should we send them?
Yeah, great. So I'm on Instagram at Zandra Clark.
Xandra spelled with A.
With an X.
With an X.
X is an X-ray, as I say when I'm on the phone. A-N-D-R-A, Clark with no E. And then Polylogs is also on Instagram. That's at Polylogs, P-O-L-Y-L-O-G-U-E-S.
Are you doing more performances that people can check out if they're in the New York City area?
Yeah, just figuring out the where, when, and how.
Okay.
There likely will be another shorter run in not too long in the future.
Cool.
And then hopefully a longer run. Mm-hmm. And maybe some other exciting updates soon. And then there's also, Polylogs is also on Facebook. Polylogs. And then there's also a website, polylogsplay.com.
Okay.
And at that website, people can join the mailing list where on the contact page where then you'll be sure to, you know, be notified when there's a new show and that kind of thing. And
perfect.
We are in New York right now, but we might be touring and stuff.
Yeah.
So even if you're out of New York, if you want to hear more,
cool.
Join the mailing list.
All right, my last question is whether it's a lesson about telling stories or about love through working on Polylogs, what is one kind of core lesson that you learned about how to tell a story or maybe about one of the themes?
As I'm thinking of that,
yes.
I also would love to hear that from you. Is something like, I'm sure you've learned a lot on this journey of podcasting, but maybe like in the last, you know, in the last month or so, something that you've been reflecting on a lot, like a learning.
From doing the podcast?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Interesting. Okay, let me take a second to think.
Okay.
I should go first because you're the guest. So then we can kind of end on you.
Okay. Pressure's off.
So one thing that I've been surprised by in terms of strategies for telling better stories, I'm surprised that it's come up in numerous interviews with, one was like a theatrical improviser, one was a writer, and then another one, I think, I can't remember what form it was, but multiple interviews, I've heard people speaking about using, like being specific, specificity in how you tell stories. And from the improviser, Lisa Rowland, who I think you may know, just talking about when she's on stage, instead of just like picking up a phone, can I see that phone? It's like, can I see that Samsung Galaxy 7? You know, as a way to create the, really give the audience something to visualize. And the same goes, I've heard that from writers. Oh, the other one I heard from was musicians. Like specificity in how they're choosing, making decisions. And I think that the way that I've tried to translate that into filmmaking is by when I'm shooting B-roll, so the images that will go over someone's interview or might be in between interviews, is trying to be more present in my setting and looking for the specific details that makes that setting unique. Filming those as my B-roll instead of just kind of getting lazy about it and kind of just like doing a wide shot and then a little bit closer and kind of going through the motions a little bit with my B-roll is really thinking about specificity of what makes environments unique.
That's really interesting, because just a sidebar before I answer your question, but in response to that, because you were asking me about the interruptions, or like when my storytellers in Polylogs say like my name and kind of remind us of the present moment. There's one of my favorite moments in the show, and this was the very first interview that I did, and this happened in the interview, and I thought this is gold. Was we were having the interview, and then all of a sudden, the person I was interviewing said, "Oh my gosh, a butterfly just flew into the room." And there's this beautiful reaction where she just watches it fly about the room and is just responding to it. And this, and then it flies out the window and she's like, "Bye, friend," you know? And it's this amazing moment of totally specific in the moment, like this is what's happening right now. And it sets us in, you know, the summer, the spring, it sets us in like her mood and we can see it in the room. And it just, it is a beautiful interruption from her story, I think, because, you know, some storytellers might edit that out because it interrupts the story. But I love those interruptions because they're real. They're human. We have interruptions all the time. Mm-hmm. So to me, they make stories better.
That's cool.
So, lesson learned about storytelling or love and or love. And this is maybe a lesson that applies to both. I think something that I've learned, especially over the course of Polylogs, but really over many years, I think, is, and I'm trying to think like even how to articulate it, because it's sort of a, it's like an understood concept, but something about openness that, and I think it has to do with, you know, arriving to a scene where you think you're going to tell a story, but actually accepting your not knowingness, and your kind of innocence in, you know, you don't have the answers. And so being open to what the world can bring you. And I think to me, that makes the journey of storytelling, first of all, of like story finding, really amazing, because if you walk around thinking a story can happen anywhere, then like the world kind of glistens and you can see, you know, a story there, a story in this small detail, a story here. And that to me is so much more powerful than walking around the world saying, I'm going to go get this story, and having blinders on to the rest of the world around you. I think there's so much more joy in being open to what the world throws your way. And I think that applies in love too, is like, it, if you have a set idea of what you want and need, you can totally miss so many things that could have come your way. And I think that applies to like new love, and it applies like in any relationship, of being able to be open to what your partner has to offer you and how you and or your partner may change over time, and genuinely having like an open, joyful curiosity about those ways you might change, or the stories that might come your way, or the things you might encounter. I think that's like the most exciting thing about life to me, you know, is just like being open to all of those things, because like, you never know what's going to happen. Life surprises you.
Woo! Nice! Yeah.
That's how I feel.
Right on. Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Sandra, thanks so much for joining the podcast. Yeah,
thanks, Austin.
That's it for episode 10 of the Austin Meyer podcast. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Zandra is just one of those people who glows with positive energy and creativity, and the way she thinks about storytelling really inspires me. So I have no doubt you are definitely going to see her name in lights very soon. Thanks as always to the Sunrunners and Opus Orange for today's theme music, and I hope everyone is having a lovely holiday season with friends and family. I will see you back here next week for another episode, and until then, go out and tell some stories.